Good afternoon. So, last time we took our idea of pipelining and applied it to our single cycle processor by taking those stages, which previously were purely just a logical way of dividing up the processor, and turning them into things where we'll actually do things one step, then the next for each instruction. To do this, we needed to have our PC update, which our textbook previously listed at the end of everything, to be in the joined with the fetch stage, because after we fetch an instruction in the next cycle, we want to be able to fetch another instruction, even though we haven't gone through the later stages of the pipeline to finish those yet. We talked about the discipline for making pipeline stages, that pipeline stages generally are going to take some values from the prior stages registers, outputs that were produced in the previous cycle for them. They're going to do some work on them and write the results to the next stage's registers. And they might have some components they manipulate, like in the memory stage, that's where we do anything that involves the data memory. So if we need to read from memory, we're going to do it based on the inputs to the memory stage and send the result to the outputs of the memory stage. We also learned that when we need a value from a prior stage, like for example in the memory stage, we thought, oh, we probably need to know whether we need to set the read enable or write enable flags in the data memory. And we did that based on the iCode. We needed the iCode. The iCode was set in fetch. If we wanted to have the iCode, we needed to get it from our previous stage, or execute stage. And our execute stage shouldn't produce it, so it needed to get it from its previous stage, the decode stage, which needed to get it from its previous stage, the fetch stage. So whenever we have a case where we're like, oh, I need to know this, our previous stage knew about it, we need to pass it through all the pipeline registers in between. We talked about a big problem with our simple pipeline processors. We looked at just our add case, and we discovered that sometimes we produced the wrong answer. And the problem was that we read an old version of the value just because when we were reading, the new version hadn't been written yet because of the way the pipeline executed the instructions. This we called a data hazard, where our pipeline didn't do the right thing with the natural implementation, so we need to somehow fix this. We also talked about control hazards, which is the same problem, but instead of just getting the wrong value, we don't even know what to do. We don't know what instruction we go to next. We don't know how to set the PC. We just can't do the fetch stage. We don't know what the input is. And for both of these cases, we learned about the conceptually simplest way of resolving the problem, which is stall, that we're going to insert nops. Since we don't want to change the instruction set architecture and change what all the compilers and assembly writers have to do, we're going to have the hardware insert knob. So the hardware is going to have some logic to detect, oh, if I kept going here, I'd be reading an old value, and it's going to hold instructions where they are and send no ops down the pipeline instead of the actual values for the instruction. So any questions about any of this stuff we covered last time? Okay, so I'm going to talk a little more about our control hazards. So I mentioned one of our control hazards was we were, say, doing a conditional jump, and we don't know whether to do the conditional jump until we actually set the condition codes, which is potentially happens in the previous instruction. And here you see that we've just read the values for that from the registers, but we haven't even actually used those values to add at the time we need to do the subtraction and figure out what the condition codes are at the time we need to read them. And we have this conceptual idea that maybe we just send through junk. Now, when we actually implement our conditional jump, our discipline is going to be that we're going to say everything we do with the condition codes happens in the execute stage. That when we draw our boxes for what is in what stage of the processor, the box that contains the condition codes is going to be the execute stage. So if we want to do something with the condition codes, we better do it from the execute stage. And this is going to apply even for conditional jumps. So our conditional jump is going to go from fetch to the code to execute, and the operation it's going to perform and execute is reading those condition code registers and computing that conditions met flag you might remember from last week. And after it computes that, we're going to, use that value and send a signal to the fetch stage, which was waiting previously if we're doing stalling, about what the result of the jump actually is, and then it's going to know what the next instruction to fetch is. So any questions about this idea, that the jump goes down the pipeline, and after the jump we don't know what to do, so if we're stalling we wait until the jump gets far enough in the pipeline to figure out whether we keep going. Okay, so this is stalling with jump, and we're going to apply the same principle for return. We want to, for return, read the return address from the data memory. And to do that, we need to send the return down to the memory stage. We need to, in fact, do even some work in the decode and execute stage. We need to, read the stack pointer. We need to compute, the new value of the stack pointer. In the execute stage and in the memory stage, we need to read the return address. And once we've gotten there, rather than just waiting, which we're doing in the fetch stage previously, we can finally read the address of the instruction I want to do, and we have to send that from our memory stage to this fetch stage here, once it's actually available. Yes?
The breakup with fetch and code and execute is something that, that's all it consumes of, right? You could do more breakups in the process.
So the question is, the breakup we're doing, is that conceptual? No, because it affects where we put registers. It actually changes the architecture of the processor. And the second part of the question was, we could do more? Yes. If we had another way of dividing things up, we could do that. It would have a lot of implications for a whole bunch of the stuff we'll be talking about later today. So any other questions, such as about what happens with our return here? Okay. So when we're done with this, we got our pipeline stages. I think I went through this last time. Note that we're always doing our condition code read and write and execute. And this in particular means we don't have to worry about data hazards with the condition codes, because we always read them in the execute stage, which is after the execute stage, whatever last wrote them in our order in our program, which is not what happens for registers, where you read them in the decode stage, which could get executed before the write back stage of the thing which wrote them in our program. So when we're all done with this, we end up with 3 extra cycles for every return, because we need to wait for the return to get to memory, and only after that memory stage do we have the address available for the fetch stage near the beginning of fetch, so the instruction memory has time. We need some extra time for conditional jumps to do the stalling while we're waiting for the jump to get to the execute stage so we can compute that condition's met value. And we need some extra time for data dependencies in order to stall, in order for that to happen. And in particular, this last one is really annoying, because patterns like, add R8, R9, and then add, something else into R9, this sort of assembly code is really common, that we keep manipulating the same value, and this is going to be precisely the almost the worst kind of hazard we could have. And it happens all the time, and we'd really like to avoid that. So can we do better? Yes.
So is this for a processor 5 or 6?
So this is for what we talked about. We have the fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back, like described in our book, and with stalling.
So
for all hazards. We're going to do a bit better than this. So for return, we're not. for return, we're going to say, well, we can't read memory early, and we can't do that because, like, maybe something else is reading memory. What do we do if that happens? You know, that's not an easy thing to resolve, so we're just going to not deal with that. We might talk next time about what real processors do to make return faster. And we're going to use a trick for data dependencies, however, that's going to be very beneficial. And that's that we're going to observe, oh, well, you haven't written back the value yet, but you might have already computed it. And that value is just waiting to get to the register file. And instead of waiting for it to get to the register file, we can just shortcut that value, you know, and use it where we need it. And you can see that in our initial example where we had our hazard here, where we're supposed to read R9 becomes 1700, and we're supposed to read that 1700 in the next instruction, and if we don't do anything, we end up reading 900. But if we look in some other pipeline registers, oh, we have our 1700. And so what you want to do is you just want to replace, move that 1700 and have it replace this 900. These both exist at the same time. So it's just a matter of moving a value from one place to another. So you can draw that out here. So what I want to conceptually do is I have sitting here, I would normally have my 900 on this wire. Old 900, I have the 1700 on this wire. And it's, you know, I really want 1700, that's the value I was supposed to read if only my pipeline had read at the right time, but it doesn't read late enough. So I just want to shortcut, so I'm gonna draw a wire there, replacing what I have there, and well, I don't want to always do that because, like, if we weren't reading from R9, I don't want to replace it with that 1700, only if we are. So if I want to do something conditionally in my hardware, the way I do that is I add a mux. So I'm gonna add a mux. So sometimes I'm gonna take 1700, send it through. Sometimes I'm gonna take the old value I read from the register file, send it through, depending on whether I actually had this register in common here. Well, in this case, I'd want to do it because I just wrote to R9 conceptually, which means the value for R9 is sitting at the input to this register down here, and that's also the register I'm trying to read from for source A. And I want to replace that, otherwise I don't. So questions about this addition? Yes. The question is, will we get to the control logic for this? Yes. I obviously have not drawn the control logic. Other questions? Yeah.
When you say control logic, it's how to know when you should take the forwarded value or the
normal. The question is the control logic how we choose whether to take the forwarded value or the normal value? Yes, that's exactly what the control logic would compute, which we will generally not draw. So there's one other case we want to think about, which is that, let's say instead of reading from R9 using source A, we read from R9 using source B. In that case, we also want to forward to replace the old R9. So we read the old R9, but not for source A, for source B. We're going to do the same thing we did, but with the other output of the register file. And as we'll see later today, we're going to have a whole bunch of other cases where we need to do this sort of thing. If you look in the textbook, there's some really ugly pictures with lots of lines. And we'll get to that later. So any questions on what we see so far? Okay, so getting to the question of what are the MUX conditions. So one question is, how do we figure out, you know, what information do we need to actually know whether to take the bottom or top input of the MUX? Someone tell me, like, describe what type of information do we want to know? Yeah. Okay, so you say you want to know what the previous instruction is? Okay. Okay, so you want to know what instruction is each stage or say? Any other information?
We want to know the previous instruction, which register it's writing to.
So you want to know a bunch of register numbers. So this processor, because it only does adds, is very boring as far as the previous instruction. But register numbers are something we want, and there's a bunch of them we actually have. So here, this is reg source A, reg source B. We have here is going to be D dest E. This is going to be E dest E. And this is going to be W, big W dest E. And those are a bunch of registers. And we could potentially have more if we needed them. Like if we needed register A, we could add another pipeline register and send it if we needed to. So we could like have this be DRA, and this would be therefore big ERA, and so on. So this is why we went over what the naming convention in HTLRS for these in our textbook was, because here's where it comes up. So I have all these register numbers that are lying around, including extra ones I could add if I needed them, like we saw us adding the I-codes. And this is something we're going to need to figure out whether we use those MUXes or not. I guess I should mark a few more. We have, notably, we have like FRA here. So we have all these signals that have register numbers on them. And let's say I wanted to figure out whether we forward to replace the value we read from source A. So this is for this input here, this path here. I'm going to choose whether that's taken or not. So what's the condition look like? So we're going to call this output dval A, and sometimes it's going to be eval E, which is exactly this wire. And sometimes it's going to be the normal value, which is the output of the register file, reg output A. So what is the condition under which it's eval E, which is exactly when we take that bottom path through the MUX? And I'll give you like a minute. Think about it, check with your neighbor that you agree. Okay, who needs more time? Okay, so who thinks it's A? B? C? D? E? Has no clue? Okay. So, does someone want to defend their answer? Anyone? Yeah.
E is the register that you were about. with the computed value of RE and R9, which can be on R9. And if we're checking to see if RA is the same as word of 2RA. So you want to know if the register that we're using in the next command is about to change.
Okay. Yeah, so a key observation is that EDSD is where we're going to write, and what value are you going to write? We're going to write eval E. And the way I like thinking about it is that eval E and EDSD are kind of a pair. Eval E is the value we're writing, EDSD is where we're writing it. And they stay together. So after here, after this register, we have W eval E and WDSD, which are again a pair. We're going to write WDSD to W eval E. And our question is this thing we're about to write the same as what we read? And we need to know, what did we just read? And what we just read is register source A. And we need to compare that to the value we would forward, which is eval E, which is going to be in register EDSD. And so that's why the answer is, in fact, C. So you can think of this as this reg output A is a pair with reg source A, like EDSD and eval E are a pair. You know, reg output A and reg source A, you know, reg source A is where reg output A comes from, like EDSD is where eval E is going. And that's what we want to check, is whether it's the same register number we're writing to that we just tried to read from, but maybe got the wrong value. So, any questions about this? Yeah. So, which instruction is EDSD from? So, if instruction 2 is in here, then instruction 1 is in the execute stage, and EDSD, we draw like a line around the execute stage as part of the execute stage. Okay. So something notable is that I haven't gone through all the cases where we might do forwarding. So for example, let's say I put a nop in between these instructions, or here. Then, instead of the value being on EDSD, we'd have the value on WDSD that still would not be written to the register in time, register file in time, and we'd solve this problem by forwarding it. We'd make a shortcut, just like the one we had before, and we'd have another input to this mux and another condition in our HCL code, which would probably involve, instead of EDSD, big WDSD. But instead of forwarding eval E, we forward big WEval. And we'd have to also do that for the second mux, and probably a whole bunch more cases. So let's think about reasoning about where do we need to forward from and to. And sort of the simple rule of thumb is that typically we're going to read registers into code, and we want to replace whenever we read a bad value with the correct one, and we're going to find out where is it when I'm doing the decode in the pipeline, and we're going to send it from there to where I need it, which is to replace the value we just read. So here's some example code, and we're going to go through figuring this out. So first we have our instruction which writes to our 9, and then the next instruction reads from our 9, and we saw this case. So we need our 9 at the end of the decode stage to replace the value that we were supposed to read, but that's not going to be right because this add instruction doesn't have its value written until here. So we need to get the value that it actually has from this instruction that computes it. It's currently in the execute stage, so we're going to get it from the execute stage. That's where it is. We also have another case here where this XOR instruction reads from R9, but it needs to have the value here, That's after it's written, that's okay. We don't need to do any work. So then we have another case where this rmoveq is reading from R9 at the end of its decode stage. And you might say, oh, but addq is in writeback. We fine. But remember that values aren't written back till the end of the writeback stage, which is just before when we're trying to read it if we don't do anything special. So in this case, we also need to forward from the writeback stage to the decode stage in order to have the right value for the rmoveq instruction. So you see we have here R11. So the subq produces R11. mrmoveq needs R11 to compute the address. So we replace the value of R11 that's old that it reads with the one from subq in its execute stage. So our forwarding is not just for, you know, these opq instructions. We also have here R11 is needed later on, so it's also going to be forwarded to this rmoveq, which needs it to compute the address to write into. So to replace the bad value of R11, it would read otherwise. And we have this case where we need R10 for the XOR, which is read from memory. So we look up, we say, oh, okay, it has it at the end of this memory stage, and that's the value I'm going to forward to the XOR to get R10. So any questions about anything here? So something I'd like to know is that we have a lot of cases here, and one thing you might remember when we made our processor into a pipeline processor is that I said I would compute the destination registers in the decode stage. And a big reason to do that is so this logic here is easier to write, because we don't want to say if it's an mrmoveq, then I do this, otherwise I don't. It's easier if we just compute what's the destination register, is there a destination register, all that stuff in the decode stage, so later on we can do these comparisons without having different cases for all the iCodes. And that's the main simplification. That's why our textbook does it. You can make a correct processor, which doesn't do that, where you like check, is this an instruction which writes to RB, but you probably don't want to, because it simplifies this logic a lot, especially since there's gonna be a lot of cases. So one thing about a lot of cases is sometimes we have conflicts. So here I have R8, and this last addq instruction needs R8, and we can say, oh, this first instruction is computing it in its memory stage, so we can use that value. And if we do that, we get the wrong answer. And the problem is that the previous instruction's also computing R8, and we need to choose which one do we want. And the answer is we want the one which is furthest in the pipeline, the most recent instruction. So we're going to want to take from the previous one, not the one before it, even though both of these are values of R8. So you may remember when we talked about MUX, or case expressions in HCL, we have this idea that you write these conditions in order, and the first condition that matches is the one that's chosen. Probably the reason that this was done is because it makes handling this sort of thing easier. That if we want the case where we go from execute to have priority, we just list it first, we don't have to write a condition, which is if we can forward from execute and not from memory, versus if we can forward from memory and not from execute. We don't have to write all those cases. We just list them in the order we want to have priority when there's multiple choices like there are here. So that means we end up with code like this, where we check, did we just read from edest e? If so, use eval e. And did we just read from mdest e, the value of dest e in the memory stage that's waiting to get to the register file? Then use mval e. And by listing them in this order, if there's an EDSD that matches, we use that. Even if there's also an MDSD, we use the EDSD that has the preference. So we get eval E, we get this one from the execute stage, not the memory stage, which was put in the pipeline more recently. So it's the one we want. So any questions about this? So another case where we have lots of forwarding is that we can have forwarding of multiple things, and this is pretty common. So here I have R8, which is from the first instruction that gets forwarded. We also have R12, and that's fine. And this is going to be pretty common that all of our operands might, you know, not actually come from the register file, because the register file is totally out of date for our instruction. So instead, we're going to replace them all with values elsewhere in the pipeline, which are the correct versions. And this isn't actually a special case, because these are different values that we're forwarding that are used for different registers. But it means that we're going to have a case for each of the registers we read. We're going to check whether we need to replace that value or not. So any questions about this multiple forwarding case? Okay, so forwarding, we've talked about it. So let's go back to our discussion of what hazards were, and we'll talk about a distinction between hazards and dependencies. So all these hazards are that we had some value that an instruction needed that came from another instruction. So for data hazards, this was a value in a register. For control hazards, this was the value of the PC that was computed based on information from the other instruction. And we sometimes also talk about dependencies between instructions. A dependency is, does an instruction need the result of another instruction? Dependencies are properties of the assembly code. They don't care what you're running it on. So if I need the result of an add instruction, it doesn't matter if I'm on my single cycle processor, where we never have to worry about pipelines going wrong, because there's one stage. Hazards are, given a particular processor, will it work before I've done extra stuff like forwarding or stalling to resolve these hazards? So whenever we talk about hazards, we need to specify a processor. For example, our single cycle processor has no hazards because instructions execute one at a time. There's no way for these dependencies to mess up what that processor does. But with our pipeline processor, there is. And if we have different pipeline processors, we'll have different numbers of hazards. So with that in mind, let's look at some, here's some assembly code. So figure out where are there dependencies between these instructions. Which of those are hazards in our five-stage processor, fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back. And which of those hazards can we fix with forwarding? I'll give you a minute or so. You might want to write things down, depending on how good you are at keeping a whole bunch of things in memory. Thank you. Okay, who needs more time? Okay, so can someone tell me about some dependencies then? Okay, back there. Four depends on three, okay, because of RCX. Okay, any others? And 5 depends on 4. Why is this? Because of our 10. Okay. Anything else? And 5 depends on 1, presumably because of RBX. Any other dependencies? Anyone? Yeah. 4 depends on 2. Okay. So why is that?
RCX plus RX, RCX.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to add RCX to R10.
So.
Oh, wait, never mind.
So it doesn't because of this IR move queue. And something to note is that the IR move queue doesn't depend on the sub queue. And that's because the IR move queue doesn't care what RCX was before it writes to it. So there's no dependency, even though sub queue computes a new value for RCX. Okay. So which of these are hazards? Someone want to tell me which of these are hazards or not hazards? You have these 3 dependencies. So which of them are hazards or not? Preferably someone who hasn't, but maybe that's not an option. Over there. So the question, is it a hazard when you can't solve it with forwarding? That is not the relevant question. The question is whether you need to do anything to solve it.
That's what I'm asking. What's the definition?
So hazard is if we don't do anything, no forwarding, no stalling, the pipeline will do the wrong thing. So something is hazard even if forwarding can't solve the problem. So, yeah.
They're all hazards.
Okay, so, and do you have a justification, how you figured that out? Okay, so you want to look at this. So what we want to look at is, let's say, IR move queue. Normally, it would write at the end of write back, and this add queue needs to read the value at the end of its decode, and that's going back in time. That time goes forward across, and that's not allowed, so that's a hazard. And we can say the same about R10. R10 would normally be written here. It needs to be read here. That's a hazard. But for RBX, it would normally be read here, written here. It's supposed to be read here. That's actually fine. Like, if we draw this line that goes forward in time, it's okay. We don't actually have to do anything to make that work. But general procedure I like doing is write out these stages, figure out where the value would normally be written, where it would normally be read, see if that goes back in time. If so, you can't do that and have that work. You need, like, would need to stall or do forwarding or something. Okay, so which of these hazards can be resolved with forwarding? Yeah. So these two hazards, you say they both can. So how do you figure that out? So we need the value here. We just need to get it from wherever it is, which is in the execute stage. The value comes from the fetch stage, so it's definitely around, still around in the execute stage, or can be pretty easily. And it's going to be around because we need to write it back. So that forwarding is fine. For the add queue, we need the value here. It comes from the previous instruction, which is in the execute stage. We need it at the end of the decode stage, which is the end of that instruction's execute stage, which is exactly when it's computed by the ALU. So that forwarding works too. So both of them are resolved with forwarding. So questions on any of this? Yeah. So the question is, do you need additional logic to put val C, to forward val C? It depends on what you do with val C when it gets to the execute stage. Potentially yes, if you can design your processor in a way where you move it to val E precisely to make this simpler, which is what our textbook does. So how about this case? There's some more complicated instructions. And let's assume that we have, that the jump is taken, but we have a bunch of instruction. We have a bunch of, we have a bunch of instructions in here that are between here, but the jump is actually ends up being taken. Look at what happens in this case. Someone want to tell me where there are dependencies here? Any of them? Yeah. Yeah, so we can say this writes to our, this first instruction writes to RBX, what reads that value, and we say, oh, addQ reads it, that's a dependency. Can follow the same procedure and say this addQ writes RCX, this other addQ reads it, that's a dependency. We could ask the same question, this addQ writes RCX, does this mRemoveQ, well it doesn't read it. Because if you remember what mRemoveQ does, and it doesn't write to its second operand, so it doesn't read from its second operand, so it's not a dependency, it doesn't care what that was. So RDX to here, that is a dependency. But the RCX that it uses to write to is not. So those are our dependencies. That so far, are there any I missed? Yeah. So instruction 3 depends on 2. Yes, so this goes through the condition codes. So the condition codes are set by addQ, and jump feeds those. So that's another dependency we have. Okay, so which of these dependencies are resolved with forwarding? So we'll ignore the ones which go over the jump for now. So which of these other dependencies we can resolve with forwarding? So we have from RBX RBX from MRMoveQ to AdQ. Yeah.
So the mean forwarding for 2 to 4.
Okay, so 2 to 4, assuming that we can just execute the jump right away, which is an interesting assumption, but if we have that, we need forwarding. So what's the forwarding look like? So we want to read the value here. So we're going to forward it from the memory stage. Okay, which we'll get to that later.
And then the first one, you need us one stall.
Okay, so for the first one, forwarding isn't enough. Forwarding alone isn't enough, and we can see that because we need the value at the end of the code before the execute happens. And if we look at where we are up here, we're in the execute stage. When is RBX's value computed? This is from the data memory. So that value is not available till the execute stage, and that's not a path forwarding we can do. That goes back in time. We can't have that work. So we can't just use forwarding, we have to use something else too, which is gonna end up being that we're gonna stall and also forward. That's gonna be the most efficient solution and what our textbook suggests for this case. And we also have this condition code issue, and we really want to know what the condition codes should be at the beginning of this fetch stage here, and they're not computed until that execute, so we're gonna have to do something other than just forwarding the value of those condition codes. Okay. So note that unlike dependencies, hazards depend on what processor you have. So if I have a 4-stage pipeline, then this is not a hazard, that this add queue will finish before this and queue, finish entirely, including writing back to R8. With a 5-stage, it will be in its write back stage when the and queue is trying to read R8, and that will be a hazard. We'll have to do forwarding for that case or stalling. So having a different pipeline will do it. Our textbooks made one particular choice, but real processors, you have other choices to choose from, and our processor designers will choose them based on what makes sense given their constraints. So given that, the idea that it's going to change in the processor, so here's a bunch of instructions, and let's say we split our execute stage into two pieces. We have a slow ALU, maybe we want to support some complicated instructions, or maybe our adder is slower because we have big registers. So where do we do forwarding and stalling to fix this? So we're going to use forwarding if we can. We're going to use stalling if we need to, in addition to forwarding. I would recommend writing out the timeline like this. And the first thing I like figuring out is where are the dependencies? Which I do by saying we're writing to R9, where do we read it? Read that value we wrote, we're writing to R9 here, we read it there, writing to RBX here, we read it there. I recommend writing things out. You probably cannot reliably remember where things are in your head. At least I can't. Yes. So you're saying you started figuring this out and you decided we need to stall. And your logic, so what was the logic behind that? So you write out these stages and so the ALU is only available after execute 2 over here. We want it here. We can't fix that with forwarding. There's a difference in time. So we're in fact, yes, going to stall and also forward. I have that prepared here. what we want to do doesn't work, so we stall, and when we stall, we move everything after it. Here I've noted, written down as if we stalled in the decode stage, we could have also stalled in the fetch stage. And because we stalled in the decode stage, the following instruction is waiting in the fetch stage because it can't go on to overwrite the other instruction. Okay. So that's a case where we have to stall and also forward. So we stall, and after we're done stalling, finally we're set up so we can forward, so we can avoid stalling even more. So are there more cases where we forward?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so what does that look like? So add Q to R and move Q, this add Q, the second add Q to R and move Q. Okay. So what is that, what line is that in this picture? Like where should I draw the line where the forwarding happens?
The second line.
The second here, okay. So here, and we don't ever go forward in time, so we forward that to the end of the decode stage there. So that's one forwarding path. We also have this R9 that's used in the second add queue, which is needed here. So we look at it's up here, so we're gonna forward that. And we have this R9, which is needed here. So that one is a bit tricky. I'm going to talk about this. So here we need R9, and it's not computed until here. And if we were replacing the writes, we would need to get it in here, and we need to stall more. But if you look carefully, well, rmoveq doesn't do anything with R9 until the memory stage, because that's the value it's writing to memory. It doesn't change the value in any way under any circumstances before that. So we can, instead of saying that we're going to forward to decode, we can say, oh, I'm just going to get it by the memory stage, or we could also forward it here. We could forward it in another stage when it's actually available, rather than stalling until it gets lined up with the decode stage. We'd have a correct processor if we lined it up with the decode stage. It would just be slower than it needs to be. So this is something our textbook does not do. Our textbook's design is that even if you could do this, you're going to keep the, you're gonna move the decode stage and you're gonna stall enough to make that happen. But real processors do this. So our textbook would stall and wait for decode instead. But real CPUs don't. Real CPUs will do these extra forwarding paths because it makes things a lot faster and it's not actually that hard to implement.
Is this for the third add
queue? Yeah, so this is the third add queue here to the RM move queue for the value of R9. The value which is being written to memory. Yes. So the question is, does this only apply when executes takes two stages? So there are other cases where other reasons the value might not be available. The most notable is if we have an MR move queue into R9 followed by an RM move queue of R9. So our textbook says we're going to stall for that because we're going to wait for R9 to be available in R move queues to code. Real processors are going to say, oh, I can just forward that value. Yes.
The last line start from cycle 3?
Does the last line start from cycle 3? No, it starts from cycle 4. So what happened here is we waited and fetched twice because we couldn't advance past the instruction that was waiting into code. Other questions? Okay, so that's a lot about forwarding, including cases our textbook doesn't do, but real processors can. And after we do forwarding, we've made all those data dependencies a whole lot better. In fact, most of them, now our processor is basically as fast as the ideal. Obviously, these extra muxes we added and the control logic are going to make things a little bit slower, but we aren't stalling except for these rare cases that involve these memory instructions. So let's talk about our conditional jump, and we're going to have another trick to get rid of that penalty, and that trick is going to be to guess and check, that we're going to guess what the jump's going to do, and we're going to start doing that. Later on, we're going to figure out whether we're doing the right thing. And if we are, we're going to do nothing. We're going to say, great, I made the right guess. Everything's great, nothing to do. And if we're wrong, we're going to say, oops, just hide all that stuff I just did, sweep it under the rug, and we don't need it anymore. We'll just undo it and go back to doing what we're supposed to do. And a big reason why this is practical is if we think about when do things actually change as they go through a pipeline. And the early stages don't actually write to much state. So our fetch stage and our decode stage, they're reading values from the instruction memory, from the register file. Other than the pipeline registers to pass things on to the next stage, they don't actually change anything. Later on in the execute stage, we start changing something. We have the condition codes, and then we have memory writes and register writes and so on. But this guess and check operation, where if we check and find out it's wrong, we undo the things we guessed to do, is real easy if the instruction's only in fetch or decode. We just forget everything we're going to put in pipeline registers, and that's it. Because we don't have to change like values in memory, values in the register file, because we haven't gotten far enough for that part of our guess to actually do anything. Yes?
Could the guess and check process be parallelized? So done in parallelization, I mean?
So
you could kind of do it non-deterministically?
So the question is, could the guess and check be done in parallel? In parallel with what?
There you go. Sorry, my brain's not working today.
Could it?
Meaning, like, if you're guessing and checking, you'd be able to essentially guess and check all the possibilities.
So the question is, could we guess multiple possibilities and do them? So you could do that, but then you need to have enough resources to try to execute multiple different instructions at once. That's generally not going to be worthwhile on this style of processor design to go over multiple cases. So we're going to make one guess, we're going to try to do it, and undo it if we need to. So in our textbook, the guess we've chosen to make, guess our textbook's chosen, is that we're going to assume when we have a conditional jump that goes to a label, that it always goes to the label, that it's always taken. This is the policy your textbook chose. They have reasons for it, but it's a choice they made. You could make other choices and still have a correct processor. So when we're right, we're going to not have that penalty of stalling. We're just going to start executing this add queue and the remove queue in this case, and we're going to save two cycles because we executed the add queue two cycles earlier than we would otherwise. If we're wrong, we're going to start executing this add queue and this remove queue, and then we're going to say, oops, and get rid of them, hide those, and the result is going to be just as if we waited two cycles and did nothing. So when we speculate right, we just send the jump not equal through the pipeline, it gets to execute, we check the condition codes, we find out, oh, everything's great, and we do nothing. We just say, oh, after our remove queue is I remove queue, just keep going. And we send the add queue and the rmove queue, which we now know are the correct instructions, the ones that were supposed to be executed all along through the pipeline, through the execute and memory stages, and right back where they'll actually change values that we worry about. So in the case where we're wrong, we're gonna make the same guess. So we're gonna try to do the add queue. That's gonna get to the code. We're fetching our move queue. And then we're gonna look at our condition code and say, oops, made a mistake. You need to do something about it. So we're not gonna let the add queue go through to the execute stage. We're gonna replace what it sent to its pipeline registers with a NOP. We're not going to let the rmove queue go through the decode stage. We're going to replace what it's sending to its pipeline registers with a NOP. And because the instructions don't change anything else, we don't have to like edit the condition codes to fix any wrong condition codes or anything like that. That's enough to undo those instructions because they only got into decode. And then rather than fetching the rmove queue we saw on the previous slide was after the rmove queue, we're going to fetch the XOR queue, which is the correct instruction after the jump. So we'll have to stash that somewhere, we're gonna retrieve that, and use that as the PC we fetch instead of the actual normal next PC of the rmove queue instruction. So this process of undoing the wrong guesses is known as squashing. Yes, that's the real professional term. That's where we undo the wrong guesses, we get rid of the values and all the effects of the instruction. In this case, all our effects are things in our pipeline registers. In real processors, sometimes they squash when instructions are further on in the pipeline, so they might need to do things like update the condition codes with a saved value. So any questions about these timelines for our conditional jumps when we're guessing right or wrong? Yes.
What if we have a pipeline that has four stages so that it's further into the stages before we realize it?
Yeah, so the question is, what if we can't check our guess until like we get to the memory stage? And the answer there is that if you want to make that possible without stalling, you need to have some way of undoing the operation, which is going to be more complicated than clearing the pipeline registers. So one example is you might, when you update the condition codes, stash the old value somewhere so you can restore it later. And when you update memory, you might stash the old value of memory somewhere so you can put it back later. This gets awfully complicated, but real processors do similar things. There's sort of elegant strategies for doing it, but they're pretty complicated and a topic for probably 4330. If you want to take that class, which is allegedly offered next semester. 4330 is advanced computer architecture, which has not been offered for like 10 years, but it has been on the books. So, assuming nothing changes. Okay, so this is our speculation. We've undone things, and even if we're not right all that often, this can be a big benefit. So let's say I have 3% of my instructions are not taking jumps, 5% are taking jumps. So I have 8% of my instructions are jumps, like a little over 60% of them I guess correctly. And on the other ones, I guess wrong. And then I have a few other instructions, and we're assuming forwarding basically makes them all take one cycle for the non-control hazards. Returns, we have this 4-cycle delay from stalling, so we didn't solve that problem. And we can compute the number of cycles an average instruction takes, the mean throughput in terms of cycles per instruction. So if you want higher is better, you invert this number. In this case, lower is better. And we find out that basically, with this prediction, even though we're only right like 60% of the time, and even though only 8% of our instructions are jumps, we end up getting like a 10% faster processor. So this is a big benefit for like not very much work. In fact, the case where we guess right is much simpler because we don't have any stalling logic. And we don't have any other special logic. And the squashing logic is not actually very complicated compared to stalling. Like, it's basically the same amount of complicatedness. Okay, so any questions on how we got these performance number guesses given a particular mix of instructions? Okay. So if we're doing this kind of prediction of we're guess and check, this is going to change how we do our PC update. And we also need to change how we do our PC update to handle stalling. So let's look at what that might look like. So here I have my PC, and the naive thing is what I do in my fetch stage is I compute the address of the next instruction, and then I send that on to the program counter. And we know we have some other cases we need to handle. So here are, I think, all of them. So we have that sometimes we need to stall. Stalling is just that we take the PC, we send it through back into the PC. We don't let it change. So that's what the top input of this MUX is for. Sometimes we go to the next instruction normally. Sometimes we have a conditional jump or an unconditional jump or a call, and we get this address from the instruction, and that's where we go next, either because it's our guess or it's because the actual destination of a call or unconditional jump. That's our jump target. Sometimes we have to fix up a wrong jump, or we have to fix up a return where we're waiting to read the value from memory, and we need some other input to get either the jump address, you know, the address after the jump, the place where if we guessed wrong, we need to go back to, or the return address we just read from the data memory, and we need to substitute that in for the PC. And to control this, we have this logic where we need to figure out, do we need to stall, which is like handling the return. We'll talk about how you might figure that out next time. We have our, like, was the jump taken or did we guess wrong from the execute stage. We have information about, like, whether we have a return address available or not. That all goes into this control logic. So our textbook does this a little differently. So the most logical thing is we have our PC, which always goes to the instruction memory. Now that's what we've seen so far. Our textbook changes this a bit for the pipeline processor. And what they do is they just take this MUX here and they move it a little bit. So instead of having the MUX here, they just move it up here on the other side of that. And so to do that, they have now a predicted PC, because that's the value before this, and the real PC is the value after this MUX. And rather than computing it in the previous cycle and storing it in the PC, we store the normal next instruction in the PC, in this predicted PC register, and we use that to compute the real PC where we take into account things like mispredicted jumps and returns and possibly stalls. But this is just moving the logic around. You can make a correct processor where you don't do that. Our textbook did it because I think they thought it was easier to understand branch prediction, this guess and check thing, with that change in the logic. That the guess is in the predicted PC register and the fix comes afterwards, but it's equivalent if you do it before. It just changes what cycle these come from. So here, the address from RET is from the write back stage, whereas previously, the RET address is from the memory stage, because this is at the end of the cycle versus the beginning. So any questions about this rearranging? And so to make this a bit more concrete, you know, basically what we're doing is instead of setting our PC, our instruction memory input, to directly to our register, we replace the PC register with this predicted PC, and we have a whole bunch of cases for things that we don't handle in the normally, like we had a conditional jump and we get the jump next instruction address from wherever it is. So I think that's where I'm going to leave off today. And next time we'll talk about how we implement things like stalling and squashing in HCL.
Are there ways that we can